Further delay, I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Dr. Rona Novick. Rona Novick is the co-educational director of Hidden Sparks and the dean of the Azraeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at YU, and holds the Rain and Stanley Silverstein Chair in Professional Ethics and Values. She served for many years as the coordinator of child psychology in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Schneider's Children's Hospital, as the clinical director of the Alliance for School Mental Health, providing outreach services, treatment, and training to schools, families, and communities. She developed the Brave Bully Prevention Program and is a trained cognitive behavior therapist with her own private practice. As one of the two educational directors for Hidden Sparks, Dr. Novick provides training, supervision, and ongoing mentoring to the Hidden Sparks teams of coaches, principals, and internal coaches. And Dr. Novick has been featured in an Ellie Talk, which you can Google and find online. I'd also like to introduce Eitan, who works behind the scenes to provide us with technical support. Welcome to all, and Dr. Novick, the floor is yours. Eitan, why don't you shift over the controls?
Good evening, everybody. Welcome. So glad to be talking with you about something that I think is so important, which is really how do we motivate our students and our children, because motivation is so key to all human growth and behavior. And, of course, our ideal is always that children would want to do things, that they would be internally or self-motivated, and that they'll grow to be self-motivated, make good choices, work hard, strive for success. But we know that even adults sometimes struggle to do this, even ourselves sometimes struggle to do this. So we're going to explore together tonight what we know about how to support this kind of behavior, motivate behavior, and how we can grow our children and our students' motivation. Please feel free to use the chat room at any time to share your thoughts and concerns. And at various times, I'm going to ask you to use the chat room so that we can dialogue about this. And hopefully today we'll get to understand a little bit about how motivation relates to the behaviors that we see. We'll be a little bit reflective about our own motivational boosters and what motivates our children and our students. We'll look at the difference between feedback and reinforcement, and we will learn some of the basics of positive behavior support so we can see how to be effective reinforcers and expand our motivational toolbox. So I want us to start by thinking about our own motivational equation. Think of something that you do willingly, that you enjoy doing, you love to do. Nobody needs to pressure you. Use the chat room to share something that you do willingly and perhaps even the reason why you do it. And then think of something that you avoid doing or that you do it, but you do it reluctantly. And share your examples in the chat room. Somebody said, go for a walk. I love these. Take a hot bath. You exercise every day because it feels good. That's great because that's something I avoid doing or I do it very reluctantly. So it's nice to see that somebody exercises and it feels good. My do something willingly will always be eat chocolate. Nobody needs to ever remind me or ask me to eat chocolate. One of the things that we need to think about as we are sharing those behaviors, and I like the way people are responding, that the reasons that they do some of the things they do, like exercising, is it feels good, and someone avoids it in the cold weather, obviously, because it doesn't feel good, or you avoid cleaning because it seems pointless, the house just gets messy again. Miriam, who talked about you willingly read, think about why you willingly read. I'll come back to that. Reading is an excellent example as we think about our children and our students. What I want us to think, though, about as we think about our own behaviors, and keep the behaviors you wrote down in mind, I want us to think about all of these different boxes on this slide that contribute to building behavior. There's the context, our history or experience, our skills, and our motivation. Whether or not we'll engage in any behavior, whether it's cleaning the house or eating chocolate or exercising, will depend on a combination of these factors of the context, history, skill, and motivation. So obviously, if we want to help our children engage in a particular behavior, then we need to look at, let's take this example, we want a child to do homework. We need to look at how these factors interact. Well, maybe the context is that it is 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm at my desk, and I'm ready with my book. That's a context that kind of speaks to doing homework. It would be very different to assume that a student would or a child would do homework if they were on the ball field, the sun was shining, and they were playing with their friends. That's not a context that is likely to produce the behavior of doing homework. Now, what about history? Well, when you've had homework in the past and you've done it and it wasn't too hard and the whole process wasn't too painful, so that history will also contribute to me doing my homework today. And then what about my skills? If I actually know how to do homework and I know how to do this particular homework, that also makes it more likely I'm going to do this behavior. And finally, motivation. I love how it feels when I get the answers, when I see the page all completed with my work. This is, of course, an ideal picture. Here are all of the stars aligned to lead to doing homework. But let's take another example where it's not a behavior we want to see. It's a behavior that many teachers report as disturbing to them and something that they often want to decrease or squelch in some way. Well, the context for a child calling out in class, imagine a class where there are really no clear expectations of how to get the teacher's attention. There's not a system of raising your hand, or some teachers have putting a signal. Some teachers have a Dixie cup with a stick that you put it on the corner of your desk that shows that you need help or assistance. Historically, imagine coming from a home, a family, where the person who gets attention at the dinner table, at the Shabbat table, in the car, is the person who's the loudest. Imagine that your personal skill set does not include patience. You are not good at waiting. And then in terms of motivation, imagine that when you call out, the teacher sends you to the hallway where you get to do something you absolutely love doing. You read. Several of you, by the way, talked about reading as something that you require no external motivation. You find it very relaxing. I find it so interesting also. Some people love yoga. Some people avoid doing yoga, or they don't do it because there's no context to do it. So those are very good examples of how these four elements, the context, the historical experience, your skill set, and motivation all play a role. What positive behavior support suggests is that in the same way that we support learning, we can support behavior. And we can grow behavior. We can create a likelihood of success for the children and the students in our lives when we can impact the context, the history, the skill, and the motivation. So let's look at all of those and how we do that. Remembering the behavior you selected as one that you avoid, the behavior you thought about that you choose often not to do, I want you to think about, are there contexts or situations or environments in which you're more likely to engage in that behavior, even though it's not something you choose to do? For example, I have to say I do like to drive kind of fast. And there are environments where I will drive fast, but there's a speed trap near my home. And so that context, those reminder signs, and knowing that people have gotten tickets, that context really changes the likelihood that I'm going to engage in the behavior. Let's think of our behavior example of calling out. What context would you say would set the stage for less calling out. And here I want you to use the icons that are underneath the list of all our names to vote for your answer. If you would clarify class rules and expectations, have your students restate those rules before each lesson is a review, raise your hand. If you would change the offending student's seat, or stand closer to him or her, then indicate with I made it red here, but it's a green check mark. And if you would adjust your lesson, giving each student a miniature whiteboard so that they could write their answer to each question and hold it up to show the class, use the red X. Vote with the red X. Go ahead and vote now. Which of these three things would be your preferred way of creating a context for success? I only see a couple of people are starting to vote. Ah, good. More and more, I see your votes coming in. Very good. What's very important to remember here is, in this case, there isn't a right answer or a wrong answer. All of these potentially could provide a student with a context for success. And I'm going to suggest that one of our jobs as parents and grown-ups is to be miniature, for lack of a better word, detectives or scientists experimenting with changes in context in order to discover and help the children and students in our lives discover the context that do create positive behavior. For those of you who said that, you know, you don't do yoga because there's no context for it, or it's hard to clean the house because, you know, it's only going to look dirty again, think about how context would shift the likelihood of our behavior. So think about the fact that I might not like to clean my house because it's just going to get messy again. But if the context is that a really important visitor is coming or someone I really want to impress, well, that might totally change the way that I feel about cleaning my house, and it might increase the likelihood that I do it. Now, every time that we look at one of these issues, whether we manipulate or change or alter the context in order to set the stage for success, or whether we deal with history or skills or motivation, I'm going to look together with you at what are the pluses of doing this and what are the possible negatives. So a really big plus of focusing on the context of behavior in order to change it is that we're dealing on the prevention side of the equation here. Changing the context is something that you do before the behavior happens. So it is totally different from traditional behavior responses or responses to behavior. It isn't, you did something wrong, I'm going to punish you. This is a totally different approach. It says, I'm going to think ahead of time, what can I put in place that's going to create success? And I will tell you that in virtually all areas of parenting and education, an ounce of prevention is worth several tons of cure. It is so much easier to support growth than it is to deal with deficits after the fact. So an ounce of prevention is amazing. The other really nice thing is that in focusing on context, I may eliminate any need for consequences. I may not need to think about what am I going to do when my child or my student calls out, because I've created an alternative. I've created a context where calling out is so unlikely to happen that I don't have to deal with those negatives. It's a huge success that I allow the child to experience success when I use this approach. And as a potential positive, and I say this as a potential positive, this is something I can do with no participation or knowledge of a child. In other words, if I want my child to come home and do their homework, I can create a setting, a nice desk, a nice area, I can have everything ready, and I can do that whether or not the child joins me in that process. Now, the reason I say that is a positive, and you'll notice if you look on the negatives, it's also the last item on the negative. I really want us to take away this evening the notion that what we are doing 99% of the time with our children and our students, not to our children and our students. So why is it a positive that it requires no participation of the child? Well, because sometimes the child isn't ready to partner with us and engage with us, or developmentally, the child may not have the capacity to generate all of the alternatives that might change the context. And if you think for a moment about our own adult struggle to change our behavior, just think about how hard it is for you sometimes to figure out, one of the hardest behaviors to change has to do with dieting and exercise. How hard is it for you to keep to a routine of either some kind of dietary restriction or some kind of exercise regime? And how many times it may have taken you to figure out, well, what if I exercise first thing in the morning? Or what if I put those high-calorie foods in the back of the cabinet? Or what if I take a different route, or I don't stop at Starbucks, so I won't, you know, buy Nosh at my favorite candy store? We are adults, and it took us a lot of effort to figure out how to use context to help us. Children may not, and particularly very young children, may not have a whole array of alternatives, and we may be able to do this even if they're not ready and prepared. Now, what's the negative? What's the downside of focusing on context? Sometimes it requires extra time and energy. It is, I will tell you, very easy to just say, well, I'll wait to see how my son or daughter comes to the door, and I'll wait to see whether or not they do their homework, and I will either praise or scream depending on their behavior. I'll either cajole, beg, you know, or threaten depending on what happens. That requires no preparation and no advanced thought. Unfortunately, it also doesn't work very well, and it leaves everybody feeling poorly. It does take extra time and energy to change the context, to experiment with those contexts that will work, but I would like to suggest that it's a great investment of your time. The other negative, which is really not a negative, it's just the extra work, is that it's much easier to create contextual cues for success when you really know children well, when you understand that child's strengths and challenges and preferences. This is easier for those of us who are parents who are dealing with small groups of children, even in large families. We have time to spend with each child individually versus in a classroom where you may have 20 or 30, and if you teach on a higher level, you have, you know, every 40 minutes a new group of 20 or 30 students whose strengths, challenges, and preferences you need to get to know. I'd like to suggest again that is time well spent. And back to this notion of we can change context without a child, that can be a negative because our goal for our children and our students is always going to be not that we are their behavior modifiers, not that we are their behavior managers, not that we are the ones who forever need to provide positive behavior support, but that they become their own behavior supporters and that they learn self-management. So even if we change the context without engaging the child, certainly as we work with older children, as we work with children who are ready to partner with us in discussions about, well, what do you think it would take for you to exercise or for you to get the homework done in the afternoon? We really should involve them as early as we can because it teaches them that really important skill of self-management. Now, the second piece of the equation I talked about is history. Our history and our experience influences whether we'll engage in a certain behavior in a certain context. Well, how could we change history or experience? We can't go back in time. But what we can do is we can be forgiving and understanding when we think about a child struggling with a particular behavior and recognize that it may have been ingrained over time. We also can be meticulously careful that we write a better history going forward. Take my example before about the child who calls out, and every time that child calls out, their teacher who loves order and quiet in the classroom says, "Rona, you go sit outside. You cannot be in my classroom when you are disturbing me and your fellow students." And Rona, who happens to be one of the people, many of you said this, who loves to read, Rona goes outside into the hallway and reads for minutes, hours, happily, gloriously enjoying my book. Historically, what I have learned through this chain of behaviors and reactions is that if I want to read, and I'm not saying that this is a conscious decision, but what I've learned on a preconscious, unconscious level is that when I call out, great things happen. I get kicked out of class, but I get to do what I love. I get to read. And so it is really important to think about, I can't change what happened in the past. Maybe last year this student had a teacher who did that, and so right now they're engaging in that behavior with the expectation that once again, historically, this kind of behavior will result in something they love. I have to recognize that, and I have to be certain that I don't contribute to that going on. Someone mentioned, Gabriella mentioned, the notion of learned helplessness. Learned helplessness is an absolutely perfect paradigm of where historically children have learned, my efforts don't bear fruit, and we have to work really carefully when we're working with a child who shuts down, who gives up, to recognize that this has come from somewhere, that unfortunately life, adults, parents, other children have allowed them to believe that their efforts are not worthwhile and aren't going to be fruitful, and we have to help create a new history. So let's move to an area we can help much more. Yes, Gabriella, I'll come back to how we help a child overcome. We're getting there, so I ask for your patience, and we will get there. How we help, the next area is skills. And very often, what is behind a challenging behavior is actually a missing skill. And one of the great difficulties and challenges and missteps that we make when we think about behavior plans or behavior management or contingencies, well, I'm going to reward or punish a child if they do X or Y, is that we cannot do that if the desired behavior is not in the child's repertoire. Think about, you know, you might offer me $1 million to run a marathon. But I've never run a marathon in my life. In fact, I have a knee issue. I don't really run. It's not recommended. I don't know that I could ever run a marathon. So what good would your motivation do? What good would the context do? You might plop me right in the middle of the New York City Marathon with everybody running around me, and I still might not engage in that behavior because I don't have the skill. And running a marathon is a perfect example because so many skills that we want children to develop require time and practice and training. So let's look at some of the challenging behaviors that we often want to ameliorate or help our children learn to control. Calling out. Well, the lagging skills include patience and planning. I may call out every 2 seconds and say, Mora, I need a pencil. Mora, I need, because I don't have any planning skills to know that let me just ask once that I need a pencil and a paper and my chumash. So I ask for 10 different things all at once. I may not have the ability to delay gratification. You may know the famous marshmallow test. The test of the delay of gratification. A child is presented with a marshmallow on a plate in front of them, and the experimenter says, you can have this marshmallow right now, But I'm going to go out of the room, and I'll be back in 5 minutes, or 1 minute or 30 seconds. And if you can wait, when I come back, I'll give you two. Well, you can imagine very young children have enormous difficulty waiting. Our ability to delay gratification grows with age, but it's also specific to individuals. And some of us can do that very, very well, and others not so well, and some have strategies and some don't. Mindy's asking the question of how do we help a teacher with a large group of students who have lagging skills and they're calling out and acting out. So when you're dealing with a large group of students and with a classroom, my vote is almost always going to be start with context, by the way, not necessarily with lagging skills, because without rules, without systems in place in your classroom, and sometimes with the wrong rules. For example, I once observed a teacher who asked for help with her Chumash class. It was a third grade girls class, and she said, they're a disaster. They're absolutely impossible. And I observed her for the first 20 minutes of the class. I thought the girls were actually lovely and were doing a beautiful job. The second 20 minutes of the class, they started to be a little bit more chatty and unruly. In the third 20 minutes of the class, they were requiring much more of the teacher's control. And in the fourth, yes, you have it right, in minute 100 of the Chumash lesson, she was right, they were horrible. But here's the context issue. No third grader should learn anything for 100 minutes sitting in their seat straight. It was a setup. The context was all wrong. If she had broken her lesson into smaller parts, if her lessons, rather than being all frontal, involved the girls in more engaging ways, if there were times when chatting was okay and times when quiet was okay, and she had taught the girls to understand the two different contexts, when we do quiet work and when we're allowed to chat, investing in that context would decrease the need to teach all these other skills. It actually makes the skills a little bit less important. But the other piece, Mindy, is that one can teach skills like patience and planning and delay of gratification to an entire class, and guess what? Everyone benefits. I don't think there's any of us. Some of us are better at delay of gratification than others, but all of us could learn a thing or two in patience skills. And we could learn a thing or two about planning. There's always what to learn. So using class time to teach some non-academic, pre-academic skills is also, I think, a really valuable use of time. Let's look at some of these other examples. Having incomplete work or work with a lot of errors may be someone who lacks the skill of attending to details, or planning, or the particular academic skill in question. And aggression to your peers. That may be because there are students who lack social skills or frustration tolerance, and limited participation might be coming from a student who has poor expressive language skills and social skills and academic skills. So there are all of these skills that we need to think about before we move to motivation, which we will in a moment. What are the benefits and costs, the positives and negatives of building skills? Well, once again, we come back to that ounce of prevention. If I teach you how to wait for my attention, then I may not have to deal with 20 girls calling out. If I teach you how to access my attention, I may not have to deal with all of calling out. I again eliminate the need for consequences. I may not need to punish you because I've taught you a skill that you can now apply in this setting. And the benefits will exist beyond the specific behavior. Imagine if I taught a group of third graders or fifth graders or every child in your family, if I spent time, if you invested time in teaching them the skill of waiting and of patience, waiting their turn. Now, that may be something that you're teaching in the context of playing a game, but isn't it also going to have a payoff, a return for you, when it comes time to wait your turn at the Shabbat table and you're giving out Kogel. So very often when we teach a skill, we're going to have a benefit that translates to many other behaviors. And one of the great things about developing skills is we are now actively engaging the children and the students in learning what they need to learn in order to manage their own behavior. We are giving them tools that lead them towards self-management. Now, there are some downsides to this. Once again, it takes our time and energy. We cannot walk into a classroom and say, open your book, let's learn, if we've not invested the time in building the skills to learn. And by the way, we would believe it absurd. We would know it is absurd to walk into a group of preschoolers, hand them a book, and say, okay, everyone, read. We understand that with academic skills, the only pathway to success is for us to give you the component skills that will allow that success. So before we hand you a book and tell you to read, and by the way, as absurd as that is, it would be just as absurd to say, well, we're going to set the context, we're going to give you the motivation, we're going to praise you, and we're going to give you great prizes if you read, but we haven't taught you any skills. So we understand the absurdity of that with reading. We really should understand the absurdity of that with behavior as well. It's equally absurd to walk into a room full of any age students, to walk into our living rooms at home or our sit down at our Shabbat table and expect that without us teaching the skills, our children have them. The skills of how to have a conversation, how to wait your turn when other people talk, how to ask appropriately, appropriately assert yourself, and ask to be able to share something in a conversation. All of these are skills that we can and should and must teach. Once again, it's easiest for us to do this if we know a child's strengths, challenges, and preferences. If I know that I have a child who has very limited ability to wait, really struggles with that, I'm going to work differently than with a child who I know is very, long-suffering and can be the last one and is thoughtful and waits to give their answer. The downside about teaching skills is you can't force feed skills. It's very difficult to teach skills to unwilling participants. So we really do need the cooperation and motivation of children. Imagine teaching a child to read who refuses. If a child closes their eyes, you can't teach them to read. If a child says, I'm not at all interested, I refuse to do this, it's very hard to teach skills. So that really brings us to the next point. We've finally gotten to motivation, and how do we motivate? Now, in talking about motivation, we can't do this without talking about the debate that fills the literature, whether it's parents' magazines or professional journals. It's talked about in every teacher's room, and that's the notion of intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. What are the behaviors for which we are intrinsically motivated? Well, for some of us, it's very interesting looking at our chat room, because for some of us it's cleaning, and for others it's absolutely not cleaning. For some of us it's exercise, and for others it's not exercise. The important thing to realize there is that there is no one behavior that for every human being on the planet is intrinsically motivated but automatically, and no behavior that's automatically requires extrinsic motivation. We are unique individuals, and the question we have to, grapple with is it reasonable to expect intrinsic motivation for all students in all situations? I want to go back to the comment about learned helplessness and about students who have learning challenges, and I want to think about reading. Several of us, and I'm one of them, talked about reading as being an incredibly glorious experience, that we do it for the pleasure of it. And I have to say, I don't ever remember reading coming hard for me. I think I was an easy and an early reader. I'm a quick reader. I devour books. I can't go into Shabbos without several in the house so that I can fuel my passion for reading. But I certainly have seen children, some in my own family and some in the work that I do, for whom reading did not come naturally or easily, for whom it was such a difficult and painful endeavor that even at the moment when they became readers, when they could decode enough to sound out a simple book and a simple phrase and simple words, it wasn't glorious for them. It did not open doors. It wasn't pleasant. It's a little bit like me in running. I can run, but it will never be pleasant for me. It's just not my thing. It hurts. I get winded. I've got little short legs. It's just not intrinsically and I do. I know so many runners who talk about their runner's high and you get in the zone. I'm sorry, not me. So what we need to be open and honest about is that intrinsic motivation is fantastic. It's always preferable. It's great to have children and students who want to clean their rooms, help in the house, do all their schoolwork, apply themselves to their learning, strive even in the face of challenges. But let's be real. It's not possible for us as adults, and it's not always possible for children. So then we have to think about how can extrinsic motivation be helpful, and when do we need to avoid it? And it really turns out that a lot of it has to deal with how we deliver and when we use extrinsic motivation. Let's imagine these two situations. Because we have, by the way, motivators in our lives as adults all the time. You're driving to a wedding. It's at a venue you've never been to. And you turn on your GPS or your Waze or your cell phone, whatever you use. You load the address. It gives you your first instruction, and it tells you to make a right turn. But by mistake, you don't hear it right, and you make a left. That GPS voice comes along and says, recalculating, and it gives you a new direction back on the road. Helpful, right? You need that. That's the kind of motivating feedback that we need to get on track. Imagine, on the other hand, the exact same story. But after our first instruction is given to make a right turn, we mistake and go to the left. The GPS says, bad job. I know you can do better. Maybe it even says, try harder. I believe in you. You continue driving, and intermittently the GPS either says, good job, keep up the good work, or you can do better. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not getting me to my destination. I need much more specific feedback. And it turns out that this is really the critical determining factor between whether extrinsic motivation or it will harm or help behavior. When we offer praise just in order to control, it's not feedback. That GPS that just says good work or you can do better, it's just controlling me, but it's giving me no feedback. Then it actually robs me of my internal desire to do better. It's just the way our human nature works. But when praise includes feedback, then it turns out that it's helpful. It doesn't interfere with me developing my intrinsic motivation. The guitar teacher who, when I was learning to play guitar, not only said, that's great, but said, that's great, that's exactly where your fingers need to be on the fret to get that G major chord to sound better. Great, curve your hand forward a little bit. That will give you better sound. That was praise combined with feedback or instruction. I love this little picture here about, you know, given that as a child psychologist, they actually start us with rats before we ever work with children. And we had to use extrinsic motivation to teach our laboratory rats to press levers in order to get, it was sugar water in the lab that they would get fed. And rats really love sugar water, lab mice, and they will press levers for food. We never want to create children who are simply working for sugar water. We want children who are using our feedback not because we're controlling them, but because we want to grow their positive behavior and give them the control. So let's think about reinforcement and how we use it. The actual definition of reinforcement is circular. It's anything that increases the likelihood of behavior happening again. So for me, it's chocolate. You know, definitely, if I can have chocolate, it's going to increase the likelihood that I will do it again. For adults, money is a big incentive. Anytime, by the way, you open up your emails, you get your phone, what are they called, the callers that want you to sign up for this, that, or the other thing, they're using the principles of reinforcement. If you sign up today, we'll give you this extra or that extra. And they do that because there's a greater likelihood that you'll do it again. Every reward program that you have, whether it's at a department store or with your credit card, is there because they want to increase the likelihood that you will use that card again. Use your chat now to share an example of something that's positively reinforcing for you, and an example in a school or in a home. What's an example of something that you use to reinforce yourself and something that you use or that you've seen use to reinforce children? Share your examples in the chat room. The important thing to keep in mind, and we'll see this as people start sharing their examples, is because reinforcement is what increases the likelihood of behavior, it is personal. So Tamara just said, you know, extra recess to the shy child, to the bullied child who's terrified of recess, that is not going to be reinforcing. Even the things that we assume, oh, everybody loves free time, well, guess what? Not everybody does. You know, all of those things we have to remember that every child is different. Choice. Mindy, thank you. It's a great idea. We're going to get to that. Choice. Grades can be reinforcement, absolutely, for older children. 5 minutes of a story. Fantastic ideas. I love the idea, Gabriella, that you asked children how they not only was that a great job, Rona, but how did you do that? You changed so much since last time. That's wonderful. How did you accomplish that? That's terrific. These are great ideas. The important thing to keep in mind about praise is that it can be tangible. It can be things that we touch and that we give children, but it also, as many of you are saying, it can be intangible. It can be the smile. It can be the choice that I give you. It can be extra recess. Praise is best when it's both specific and immediate. Specific meaning, if I say something like, good job, or terrific work, I don't know what you're talking about. Are you referring to how I was sitting quietly, or are you referring to what I wrote on my paper? Are you referring to the neatness of my handwriting or the content of what I wrote? Are you talking about how I just gave my sister a hug or that I am playing nicely? I don't know, because it's not it's not so specific. Although, Hava, I do love the reinforcement you got today, even though your daughter was not so specific. I think for any one of us hearing, Mama, you're the best, Ima, Abba, you're terrific, would really be great reinforcement for us. And thank you for Mindy's comment also, that the bland reinforcement or nonspecific reinforcement feels so generic that it can sometimes feel empty or less than genuine. Now, as for the immediacy, the older we get, the longer we can wait in order to make the connection between the feedback and the behavior. But for very young children, we can't say to a preschooler, you know, 3 weeks ago when you shared your cookie with your playmate, I really thought that was great sharing. That's not going to work. we have to, for young children, give that feedback fairly immediately. Now, one of the risks we have, one of the real problems we have, particularly with tangible reinforcers, but it can happen even with intangible, is the risk of inflation. We literally can have children say, well, we got, and we can have a whole class, or we can have all of our siblings in our family get together and say, well, last week when we all took our turn nicely at the Shabbat table, we got extra dessert. What are we getting this week? Or last week we got, you read us an extra book, so this week are you going to read us Starbucks? And we have to think carefully about how we create the rules around reinforcers such that our children and our students don't come to expect that this is, you know, this is the shuk, this is the marketplace, and I can bargain for, well, if I do this, will you give me that? No, no, no. This is, that's not feedback, that's payment. And by the way, if anybody ever tells you or uses the phrase, I don't believe in bribing children, I just want to make it very clear that bribery is illicit payment under the table, unofficially, for something that you probably shouldn't be doing. Reinforcement is the equivalent of salary, not bribery. And anyone can say, I really don't believe in paying children a salary for doing that which I believe they should do. Well, any adult who says that better be willing to relinquish their salary. Because, or go through, you know, life where we as adults never receive feedback or reinforcement for doing that which we're expected to do. We're all expected to be law-abiding citizens, and in exchange for that, we don't get fines and we don't get thrown in jail, and there are positive consequences and no negative consequences. So we have to apply the same rules of behavior to children as we apply to ourselves. Now, the thing that I can't take credit for this no salt, no sugar, and cost no money phrase, Rob March, who's an expert in positive behavior support, is the person who first introduced it to me, and I love it because I think it reminds us the best way to reinforce positive behavior in our children has to do with us. And it has to do with us thinking creatively about things that have meaning in the lives of children and can communicate to children very specifically that they're doing a good job and give them feedback about the great work that they're doing. And by work, I mean in managing their own behavior. So some ideas, and some of them you've already shared, are activities like recess. And activities, by the way, can be given in increments. So it can be, and I love, by the way, when activities are logical consequences. Class, because we were so effective and efficient in doing our work, cleaning up our space, and getting ready for our transition, we now have extra time to read that story. Family, because everybody took their bath and cleaned up and got ready for bed so wonderfully, we have time to play that game that you love. Or I can tell you that chapter of, you know, the next installment in the story of our family. So that's a logical consequence, and that's using an activity. We can also use privileges, a later bedtime, the ability to sit in a special chair at the table, to have power, control, or choice, which is often a privilege, can be enormously reinforcing to a child. And again, it's sometimes the logical consequence. Because you were so good at being planful and organized, I'm now going to allow you to plan and choose what lunches we're going to have this week. Now, by the way, sometimes what we're actually giving is the illusion of choice and not real choice. In one school I know, the class that achieves the best on whatever level they're considering, whether it's academics or behavior or attendance, but the class that is singled out for the best achievement in a particular week is allowed to choose the lunch menu for the following week. But it's an illusion of choice because there are only five options. It's fish sticks, pizza, filet chiquettes, hamburgers, macaroni and cheese, and peanut butter and jelly. Those are the five choices. The only thing that that class gets to choose is which one happens on which day of the week. And even though I will tell you that we might sit here and say, well, why is that so exciting for a class? That class walked around the school building all day on Monday saying, it's pizza today because of us. You know, we chose pizza today. So sometimes even the illusion of choice and the illusion of power can be a very rewarding, reinforcing opportunity for children. What do I mean by rentals? That's here on the slide. Very often, parents in particular will give children a concrete item as a reinforcer. They will say, you did such a wonderful job. You've worked for so long on X or Y. Here is a new game for your electronic device. Here are those rollerblades, et cetera. Here's a new, you know, baseball mitt. The minute we give something, especially something big to a child, they have it. And now the question is, okay, what did you, you know, now what are you going to give me tomorrow? Well, the other way to think about it is don't give the game, the electronic game or the new baseball mitt or the rollerblades to the child. Say, I have bought the following art supplies for the family or for you, and any time that you successfully complete X or Y or Z, it will be so amazing. We should celebrate it by you having access to Y, to 10 minutes with, to a half an hour, to being able to use the art supplies tonight. There's a question from Hi about how do you respond when a child asks or is expecting a treat or a prize for something he did before and he got the reward? I'm not sure I'm following the question, Hi, so maybe you can help me. I think
she means that the child has an expectation now, or there's an assumption on the part of the child that if they mop the floor again, they're going to
get the reward before. Am I going to get it again? So
right.
Once again, here, if my rewards, my reinforcers, have no salt, no sugar, and cost no money, I would like to say that any time I cook a great Shabbat meal, I get the wonderful reinforcement of people sitting around my table and saying, this was yummy, and maybe even asking for my recipes. And I do have the expectation if I cook a great meal that that's going to happen the next time and the next time and the next time. There's no reason to withdraw that from a child. If every time a child, I'm going to use a cooking example, asks if they can bake cupcakes, bakes you delicious cupcakes, and cleans up the kitchen beautifully, if every single time you provide the reinforcement of saying, that was amazing, those are the best cupcakes, and I so appreciate you cleaning up the kitchen, why shouldn't they get that every single time? The problem comes is when we've rewarded baking the cupcakes by saying, and because you bake cupcakes and clean up the kitchen, I'm going to buy you a toy. And then the next time, they want another toy and another toy. So I think we avoid it with some of these things. Now, the most important thing I want to say tonight is that the no salt, no sugar, no money reinforcer that is the most powerful thing you have is you and your relationship and your connection with your students and your children. There is nothing that is more important to children. No toy, no privilege. There is nothing that should be more important to them than time with the adults who love them, who are inspired by them and inspire them, who care about them, are interested in them, but here too, it's about investment, because I mean nothing to a child if I've not invested in the relationship. But if I have, then simple things like, I would like to invite you to have lunch with me today with the Mora.
I'd like to invite you to bring your lunch to my desk, and we're going to have lunch because I'm so impressed with the work that you did today doing X, Y, Z, et cetera. That only matters if I've invested time in being sure that you know that you matter to me. So motivation is critical. And ideally, we want it to come from inside the child. And that's the goal we're always working towards. But I believe that for some children, we have to realize and accept that that is not always going to be possible. That there are children for whom being active and athletic is never going to be intrinsically motivating. They are not well physically coordinated. They don't enjoy it. Do we allow them to live totally sedentary lives, or do we provide an extrinsic motivator along with context and history and building their skills in order to get them off the couch and onto the ball field? Yes. Do we have children who, if it were left to their own devices, they would never read? It's too hard for them. It's painful. It is not enjoyable. Do we allow them to be illiterate? No. We create the context for them to be readers. We give them the skills, but we also have to be willing to provide extrinsic motivation when the intrinsic isn't there. Realize that we increase motivation and make it more powerful when you are offering feedback as well as praise, when you're using intangibles, and when you're building on the relationship. Dina, your question about how do you apply this to a group of students with severe disabilities who learn using ABA-style instruction. Some people may not be familiar with that. We don't have the time to go into it. What I would say is the principles apply so that whenever, even in an ABA setting, whenever we can create a context for success and whenever we can move to motivators that are intangible, that provide feedback, and that build on relationship, we do our children a great service. I think that I know that we have to wrap up and end in a minute. I'm going to ask people to put any questions you have in the chat room, and I'll attempt to answer them. I want to emphasize that relationship is so much by closing with a story. It's one of my favorite stories about behavior support and the role of praise and reinforcement. I was working with a young man who was at the risk of not being accepted into any private high school. His parents very much wanted him in a particular high school, but he was going through middle school doing zero work and failing. No homework, nothing. He was seeing me, and every week I was working painstakingly trying to create contracts and reinforcement situations where if he did X, then Y would happen. His parents were extremely resourceful and wealthy and had offered him, I'm not joking, an African safari if he would manage to graduate middle school and get accepted into high school. If he would do his homework for 1 week, they would take him to Disney World. I mean, they were offering him the world. And here I am working week after week and getting nowhere. And finally, out of desperation, 1 week, by the way, we spent our session. He was totally belligerent and unwilling to work with me. And so the only thing we did was play cards. It was the only way I could get him to engage with me is we played cards, often poker or blackjack. I apologize. I do come from a gambling family that loves my grandmother taught me these games. And we played for chips in my office that were meaningless. My gambling family, by the way, doesn't play for money either. We play for fun. So we are playing for meaningless chips in my office, games of poker, and I'm totally fed up with how slow the work is going. And finally, out of desperation, I say to him one day, you know, I don't even know why I bother each week giving you, a contract about what will happen if you do X or Y, because I just think it's never going to happen. You're not going to do any homework. You've made your decision that you are not doing this. And I think if you did come in 1 week with homework done, you would have to call a code. I worked in a hospital at the time. You would have to call the resuscitation team to come get the paddles and resuscitate me. And I have to say, I was not proud that I said this. I really was. It was coming out of frustration. And his face lit up, and he said, "Really? Really? That's what I'd have to do?" And using all of my melodramatic expertise, a light bulb went off in my head, and I said, "Oh, yes, I would plots right there on the floor. You'd have to, my phone's right there. You'd have to call a code. Do you know how to call a code so they can come and resuscitate me?" Well, we played through the melodrama of what I would do if he did all of his homework. And he came back the next week with every bit of homework done. And what he said to me was, "What are you going to do next week? When I do my homework, Dr. Novick, what are you going to do next week?" What he was telling me loud and clear is it's not about the African safari or about Disney World. It's about the relationship. And that we've built something together in our work, even though I was very frustrated. It apparently we had connected. And it meant more to him that I would, that he had an impact on me. And that his behavior would have an impact on me. And the next week, by the way, it just, I had to do a happy dance. Luckily, he never made me do anything terrible. The week that he came in with all the homework, I did, in a very dramatic way, fall on my floor. But I told him he didn't have to call a code. I was still breathing. No paddles were necessary. And he went on to successfully complete his middle school. But I tell the story because I think it is important to remember that the best motivator we have is the connection that we have to the children in our lives and the role that we play for them. Mindy's asked where to learn more about positive behavior support. There are endless websites. The large school, the full school approach, the movement of positive behavior support, is their website is pbis.org. I'll put it in the chat room. But that website is very much geared towards things on a school-wide level, even on a district level. But if you dig down, and Florida's positive behavior support program is very rich in the resources that it has, so that if you find the links to the Florida PBIS program, you can find endless PowerPoints and resources about this approach. Really, the hallmarks are to not punish, to not have empty rewards, but to really think about growing behavior the same way we grow academic skills. Who's the guru in this field? Positive behavior support gurus are Lucille Eber out of Chicago, Bob March. He's moved recently, so I'm not sure where he is, Robert March. A lot of the work is being done, George Sukai, I'm sorry, is being done out of university programs and university partnerships with very large public school districts like Chicago and Florida. And the move in public education is that schools need to have positive behavior support programs in place rather than to have punitive discipline programs exclusively. And so that's why you will find a lot of information on websites about school-wide and district-wide initiatives in positive behavior support.